Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the committee, the Health and Human Services Finance Division, to order. We're passing out new copies of the agenda. I guess there was a typo on the agenda, so that is going on here. And we're waiting to get a quorum, and we are, I think, just one short. And so, Representative Lee, if you would come on up. Representative Lee, the chair is going to move House File 167 to be re-referred to Ways and Means, and except that we don't have a quorum. We're still waiting for one more member. So we had intended to move this bill out really quickly because, frankly, it doesn't really pertain to our committee, and it was here because, okay, we have a quorum. All right, very good. So the chair is going to move House File 167 to be re-referred to Ways and Means. Understand there is an amendment, the A5. So the chair will move the A5 amendment. And Representative Lee, could you just give us a really, really brief thumbnail of what the bill does and what the amendment does, and then we'll vote on the amendment.
Sounds good. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to present House File 167. So this bill aims to address the important public health concerns that Minnesotans impacted by pollution have when the state enters into enforcement settlements with polluters in our communities. And this bill is providing an opportunity for communities to be heard about how settlement funds can be used to address their health concerns. And currently, the MPCA often use what we call supplemental environmental projects in enforcement settlements to provide extra environmental and public health benefits. And what my bill does is that it required the MPCA to consult with the Commissioner of Health when there's deemed to be a public health concerns with a violation, and to offer public health supplemental and environmental projects. And the bill is in front of the committee because there's a cost that's associated with for the health Department of Health to provide that expertise. And then, Madam Chair, in my amendment on line 2.20 to 2.23, I have language that said that the cost of these reviews and any additional agency or Department of Health costs will be taken by the violators if they do decide to take some of these public health projects. And I just want to clarify to members that when they're offering these projects, these are voluntary for the violators to either take or not take. And then also the A5 amendment deals with health data privacy issues that were brought up from members of the Environment Policy Committee. And so this is just to address some of those concerns with regards to data privacy.
All right. Any questions for members? All right. So we will then, Representative Neuer, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, did you want us to move the A5
amendment? Oh, yeah. So the chair has moved the A5 amendment. So let's, if there's no more discussion of the amendment, all those in favor of the A5, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion is adopted. And so just for members, so the motion, we have a fiscal note in our packets. Initially, it was thought there would be some costs that might be within the purview of this committee, but the amendment just removed that, and apparently there really wasn't any anyway. This is the funding, although it involves the Department of Health, the funding would come out of other funds, so it's not really within the purview of our committee. So we just, thank you to the minority lead for letting us move this quickly just to get it to other committees where it really belongs. So with that, is there any other discussion on the bill? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate Representative Lee's work on this. I think he and I have the most industrial sites mixed in with residential areas in our city. It was developed at a time when living close to where you work was an advantage. It was developed before there were cars. And so we have had tons of Superfund sites mixed in our residential neighborhoods, real concerns about public health. I've had short-term notice from the PCA and the Department of Health about scheduling community meetings, about vapor intrusion into the basements of homes that are dangerous. For those of us who care about public health, it's kind of scary when the past comes to the future on as we learn more about these chemicals and the ways that they can seep into places you didn't expect and impact public health. So I appreciate us carrying this.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And thank you, Representative Lee. I agree. This is a really necessary bill. So with that, the Chair renews her motion that House File 167, as amended, be re-referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam
and
Chair.
It's on its way. Thank you, Representative Lee. Okay. We will move to... we have now House File 259, and we have House File 1539, and we're going to, I think these are bills that are either very similar or identical, and so we're going to have both Representative Tice and Representative Mann come up to the table to discuss this legislation, and then... I think what we'll do is we can't move two bills at once, but so we'll move House File. Representative Mann will move that House File 259 be laid over for inclusion into the HHS omnibus bill. When we get done with the presentation, we'll do the same with the other bill, and or not as you wish.
Madam Chair, we don't need to, as long as it's the same, and we need to amend them both the same because they are identical.
Okay.
I'm very fine with just doing the one.
All right. Thank you, Representative Tice. I appreciate that. So so the bill is before us, and there is an amendment, I understand. And Representative Mann, did you need to move the amendment at the outset?
Yep, I'd like to move the A1.
All right. Representative Mann moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form in which she would like to discuss it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. And so whichever of you would like to go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And thank you, Representative Tice, for all the work you've done on this now and in the past. In front of you, House File 259 deals with doula reimbursement. We are asking for an increase in reimbursement for these services, and the amendment offer just clears up some of the language. Doula services have been found to improve health outcomes for new mothers and babies. In 2013, a study was found that the rates of C-sections for doula-supported births were 40% lower than those that did not have this service. And that's a huge, huge deal. And the rates of preterm birth were also lower. In your packet, you should have a letter from support from the American College of Obstetricians. And with that, I will turn it over to Representative Tice.
All right. Thank you, Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's nice to be back. I did carry this legislation in the past years, and it's always been very important to me that we really utilize and take advantage of the doula programs that are out there. I had worked with an organization before I came to the legislature that worked a lot with women who are in crisis pregnancies. Most of them were single moms, and their doula program was surprisingly well-received, well-used, and always in demand of more doulas. It really is a nice way for the moms to go through and to have a birth that feels more compassionate, cared for. They've got somebody in their corner and probably not as scary. A couple summers ago, I traveled to the Denver area along with Representative Susan Clark, and we went and Kelly Fenton and Roz Peterson, and we were there for maternal and child health. And one of the programs we talked a lot about was the doula program and the advantages they had. And as Representative Mann said, it really actually cuts costs down by reinvesting in this program because a lot of the moms do a lot better, not only with their births, but also afterwards with the care of the child. So with that, I don't want to take up a lot more time because we all have busy schedules. I think there's some testifiers.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And I'm not sure if anybody actually defined what a doula is. I don't want to skip over that in case not everybody
all
knows.
All testifiers will get to that, Madam Chair.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Okay. We'll let the testifiers come up, and there is another chair there if you both want to come to the table. Whoever's going to go first, please state your name for the record. Go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, thank you for hearing this bill and legislators. My name is Susan Lane. I've been a doula for 22 years, and I am currently a board member of Everyday Miracles and formerly a co-founder and president of the Childbirth Collective. Just to answer your first question, doulas prepare mothers for healthy birth both psychologically and physically in several ways. We encourage regular prenatal care. Sometimes we drive our clients to their prenatal care. We offer individualized childbirth education in addition to what they may have gotten in a group program. We help mothers prepare their bodies in ways that promote optimal fetal positioning and good tone and balance of muscles that are involved in healthy birth. We encourage a positive approach to birth, reducing fear and anxiety, which interfere with normal birth hormones. And we also help to build a team approach to birth, which involves support for the birth partner, enhanced communication with caregivers, which is very important, and inclusion of other family members if the birthing person so desires. We meet with our clients beforehand. Usually there's two or three separate meetings, either in their home and sometimes just in their community, depending on whether or not they are comfortable meeting in their home. We attend the entire birth. We stay with them. We don't do shifts. We don't leave. We stay. So there is one familiar face that's there, and it provides great continuity of care. And then we see them postpartum as well, also in their homes or communities in many cases. All of this is possible because we have, this is what we're trained for, and this is basically what the service is. It's to provide this continuity of care and to make the connections. And to allow particularly to allow for our clients to have a voice, which often is not the case for low-income women when they get into an institutional setting. So it is our clients' will that we are promoting, not our own agendas. That's something we always need to make clear. I would also add to this that the agency I work with, Everyday Miracles, has been increasing the number of women they serve every year. to add to the statistics that were given you, the preterm birth rate in 2018 for Everyday Miracles Medicaid mothers was 2%. That's compared to 8.8% in the overall population. And just so you know, preterm birth typically cost $50,000 more than a full-term birth. That statistics comes from the Minnesota Department of Health, which amounts to over $3 million annually in Minnesota. So what this bill does is lay the groundwork for continued integration of doula care into the general health system. It's not the be-all and end-all. We may be back. Right now, the payment is so low that people who could bill, who have the capacity to bill, don't do it because the amount of the payment barely pays for the administrative work of billing, and then it might pay the expenses of the doula. So it's just not viable at this point in time, and we can raise this rate and still be saving money. The University of Minnesota's cost-benefit analysis was showing $1,000 per birth is not unusual. And if you look at the cost of cesareans and those preterm births, you can see how that happens. So I don't want to take any more time, but I would like you to hear from my colleague who has experiences that you need to hear. Leave it at that.
Thank you very much. And Representative Olson, you had a question. Did you want to ask it now? Okay, please. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tanya Hunsey. I work with Minnesota Prison Doula Project and also am a member of the Starting Birth Folks Collective, which is a collective of black and indigenous doulas. That's not really the reason I want to come and talk to you today. I want to tell you my own personal experience with a doula. In 2013, I left an abusive relationship and became homeless while I was 4 months pregnant. At that time, because of the stress and because of a previous injury, I was put on 100% bed rest. The only time that I could get out of my house was to go to Everyday Miracles and to spend time with my doula. It was the only time during my pregnancy that I was celebrated, where my pregnancy was held as sacred, where I was able to connect with anybody and really feel like a mom. The rest of the time I sat at home or I sat where I was staying at the time, the shelter, and was just, I didn't know what I was going to do. I thought I made a mistake by becoming pregnant. was worried what I was going to do with my life. And I'd walk through the doors of Everyday Miracles, and they would just they had this glowing look and telling me, I can't believe how big, you're great, this is going to be amazing. It was the only time that I had that connection in and was able to feel even like a human, to be honest with you. Because of my previous injury, I did have a high-risk complicated birth, and my doula stayed with me that entire time, and it was, otherwise I would have birthed alone. And that's what we're talking about a lot with the women in birthing people that we serve, is if we're not there, if they don't have a doula, many times they're alone at one of the most, you know, pitiful times in their life, where it's the scariest, most joyous, unsure and happy times, and to have to do that alone is not something that anybody should have to do. I've maintained my relationships with my doula, and my son now is 4 and a half, and we still have that relationship. One of my best friends and someone I hold and respect dearly is the executive director of Everyday Miracles, and that's a continued relationship. So building community for these mothers as well as just supporting the birth. Oh, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. We also have, okay, sorry. Oh, this one. Oh, okay. All right. Very good. Are there other testifiers who represent a man? Please come down. Welcome to the committee. If you would just give us your name and your affiliation, if you have one, and then please go ahead.
Yes. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and we're doing this as public testimony. I'm assuming this is the right time
That's
for that.
Just fine.
And my name is Nora Hall. I am a consultant who works with a program called Integrated Care for High-Risk Pregnancies. One of the practitioners in that program has joined me here. And I just wanted to make a couple of comments about how the bill that you just heard about is different from the one that we'd like to have go through. We have been practitioners in a pilot effort for the past 2 years that was funded by a statute. And I can't give you the number right this moment, but I do know what it is. And they have shown quite a lot of success over this past 2 years. They've probably seen more, seen in various forms through media and otherwise, more than 30,000 professionals and women who are experiencing this. So we are particularly concerned about African-American women and birth outcomes. It's a matter of life and death in terms of the number of women who are dying and the babies who are in poor conditions through these birth processes. I have a flyer here that has some of the statistics. I'm sure you're probably familiar with them because they've been in most major media organizations over the past couple of years. It's a serious problem. And what we do support the doula concept, so all that was said, we are supportive of that. But we have integrated teams. We found that to be very helpful in reaching out to families. And they are not just doulas. They include doulas, but there are also other paraprofessionals like chemical health professionals, for example. And there are others that Diane could talk about. So we're looking for three things in the bill that we'd like to do. One of them is for some medical assistance payments for the paraprofessionals who are on these healthcare teams, as well as some sort of a sunset for the statute that was released whereby the pilot programs were funded. And we want to have community ownership of the program. And I'm going to stop at that point. And I'd sure like to share our flyers and pilot project report with you all. It's just one page. And I'll turn to Diane to make some comments because she's actually doing the work.
Well, ma'am, thank you very much. And we'd be happy to take your handout. However, we're really here to testify on the bill that's before the committee. And I appreciate that you have something that's related but a little different. And, and you know, if there's a bill or an amendment or something, we'd be glad to consider that. But the way our process works, we really can only consider what's before the committee in the form of a bill or an amendment. So, you know, I'm going to stop you there. We appreciate hearing from you, and I'll look forward to hearing more. We'd certainly be happy to take the materials that you have for us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for coming here. So Representative Olson, do you want to go ahead and ask a question?
Sure, Madam Chair. I appreciate thank you for both to Representative Tice and Representative Mann for your work on this. This is a really important issue for better outcomes and just the experience of an empowering birth. Question is that I don't know if the testifiers or the bill authors would be able to answer, but in terms of, is there enough, I know there, is there enough doulas, will this incentivize enough doulas to be able to perform this service? Because I know we've talked about the rates have been so low that a lot of times they won't. So I saw in some of the assumptions that there is going to be an assumed growth that more doulas will do this. So that's kind of one part. And then the second part, are there enough folks on MA that request this service, or is there an awareness that needs to be built about what doulas do and that folks are eligible for doulas, you know, and with these reimbursements and things like that? So kind of a two-pronged question to make sure there's the access, access and awareness that doulas exist, especially amongst MA folks.
And who would like to take that? I'm sorry, Representative Olson, who were you directing it to?
Either whoever felt like they could, if the doulas themselves or the bill authors, either way is fine.
I can do
okay,
that.
Okay, so that would be Ms. Hanzi, right?
Hanzi. Yep.
Okay.
I am an indigenous doula and know that the way the bill is right now and the repayment is right now, we can't survive on it because, as you know, there's a chunk that's taken out for billing and administrative, and then I think at least $200. And if we're paying for parking at the hospital, we're paying for food at the hospital, we're paying for child care of our own children. So it's sometimes we're having to pay to support this woman. This will increase the amount that we're at least getting something and being able to make, you know, be honored for the work that we're doing. There are many people that know about doulas. It's become very out in the public. So we have a lot of people in our communities, in my indigenous community, in other communities that are asking, but just there's not enough people to serve them. I think this increase will also open it up to other organizations that aren't able to do the billing now because it doesn't make sense for them financially to bill.
Representative Olson?
Yeah, thank you. I think that's my question is, will there be enough doulas now to meet? Is there a shortage? Are there more requests coming from the MA community than we can currently meet with doulas? And will this hopefully help to meet those?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a terrific program. I think I have a question to the first testifier on the left.
Ms. Lane.
So, thank you. Yeah. I've been working a lot with addiction and opioid, and I know with new moms and babies, we're seeing a real increase in this. I kind of wanted to understand the role of a doula when you're doing some pre-counseling, and you might have seen something or you're aware of it. Maybe moms have admitted they're scared, they don't know what to do. What is your role when it comes to supporting that or helping that whole situation? Because a lot of times they're not there because they want to be, but they've gotten injured and they've just got addicted, right? And so we don't want to have that baby taken away if we can get mom healthy. How do you relate with the doctors with that?
Okay,
Ms. Lane.
Madam Chair and Representative Baker, our primary role there is going to be supportive, but we make referrals. We are generally aware, and if we're not aware, if I begin to work with a client in a community that I haven't worked in before, I was working with a client up in Rogers, I wasn't really as familiar there. Part of my job is to make myself familiar to what's there, how do I get there, who do I work with. And then I make sure that she gets to those resources, that she knows about them, and I encourage her to use them, and I stick with her regardless of what she does. But that would be my role, would be a supportive and referral role. Do you have anything to add to that, Tonya?
I think we see within our communities that the opioid epidemic is rampant, and one of the things that we do as doulas is support. Right, in non-judgmental support, because I am a recovering addict and know that we can spot someone that's judging us a mile away and we'll shut down and we won't have anything to do with that person. And we as doulas want to just make sure that they're not alone. And if we can break that down and just so they know they have somebody that's not judgmental and that is celebrating them, even if they're in a spot where they can't quit right now. But we want to be able to support them. in my experience, that's life-changing, because you at least have someone on your side. Because I can tell you this, that there's no woman that chooses to use while she's pregnant. That's not a choice that she's wanting to do. She just doesn't know how to get out of that. And so if you have one person that's on your side that's not judging you, it's a step closer to getting into recovery.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Baker.
And again, I totally agree with that. I think you're the best thing that could happen with a mom who wants to get help. Are you required by law, though, to report anything to the medical doctor in that situation?
Ms. Lane.
Madam Chair and Representative Baker, at this point in time, I am not aware that we are.
Okay.
And I, the one thing that I would add that is a benefit that the doula has is we're meeting with these women, these birthing families outside of an institutional setting. So we are always meeting with them either in their home or in their community, whichever is most comfortable to them. We get to know their families. We get to know their relationships with other people. And this contributes a lot to how we can help them make healthy connections.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Schumacher and then Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Doug Berg with this. The fiscal note was assuming with the 6-visit cap on the okay, it looks like you have an answer. If you could just respond
Mr.
to that
Berg.
And the amendment. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumacher, the fiscal note is actually on the amendment that removes the 6-visit limit. So it isn't on it with the 6 visits. However, if you read the narrative in there from the department, it says the assumption was that there would be 6 visits. So effectively, the fiscal note would be the same whether we adopted the amendment or not.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. It's hard to stump Mr. Berg. It really is. We all try, but it's hard. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just so grateful for doulas. It's unfortunate that you're probably getting the lowest payment in the whole birthing process as a care provider. But I wish I had the foresight to use doulas in my pregnancies. They would have gone a lot smoother. But I wasn't that smart then. I just want to point out that this is probably one of the best investments the state can make in terms of improving birth outcomes and the health of the mother and the child. We're only spending $19,000 investment in 2020 and then up to $50,000 in the next biennium. So I'm going to really encourage the chair of this committee to make sure this gets in the budget and we can improve these payment rates going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. So my question, you know, since this is the fiscal committee, is just how these numbers were arrived at. You know, why $47 in particular for a prenatal or postpartum visit, and why $488 for attending and providing, if you can? I mean, I know that all rates are at some level arbitrary, but if you could just kind of give us a sense and
generally, we are Madam Chair. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, please go ahead. We're taping everything, so we have this weird formality back and forth. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, the rates were basically set to pretty much double the present rates. They are also in relation to what other care providers often get, and in relation to the training that's required. These are not units of care, so the $47 may be for an hour or maybe for 3 hours. That's not a unit. That is an amount for a time, a visit. So we tried to have our total be below what the cost-benefit analysis at the University of Minnesota has shown is going to be a typical savings per birth. So that this is a rate that increases our amount that we think will make it possible to recruit more doulas and to serve more clients while at the same time realizing the savings in the program. Right. That's not our first concern, but it is a concern.
All right.
And we know that.
Thank you very much for that response. Okay. So other questions? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is, are there enough doulas for the number of pregnancies? And if not, how do you prioritize who would be able to receive the service?
There are enough doulas in, I mean, Minnesota has a higher density of more doulas per capita than any state in the country, in the metro area, particularly the greater metro area. But we have doulas in every county as well. I mean, there is, I don't think there's a county that doesn't have any doula serving it. Are there enough doulas for 40,000 Medicaid births a year? No. And I don't know that there ever will be. And I think the business of prioritizing hasn't happened yet because we haven't had a critical mass of doulas that was large enough to be increasing those numbers. This is what we're hoping to do, and we may be stuck and have to start prioritizing. But right now we're trying to take all comers.
Yeah, and Madam Chair.
Madam Chair,
just follow up. I'm quickly reading through the information that was handed out, and it's talking about high-risk pregnancies. And so I guess my question on that line, do we, in the event we do not have enough doulas, do we prioritize high-risk pregnancies?
Ms. Lane.
Madam Chair, Representative, there's not a system for that now, no. However, one thing that does happen is that we receive a lot of referrals from the clinics and health organizations from nurses and physicians and midwives. And many of the referrals we get from them are their highest risk. They look at who really needs a doula, and that is who they refer to us first. We have to develop a system if we get to that point.
Thank you, Madam.
All right. Thank you very much. So is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill? And so this is fine. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tara Erickson. I'm here representing Hennepin County Medical Center and both the Professional Association for the OBGYNs in the state. I did want to answer a question that Representative Baker asked about reporting and pregnancy. And it's good that he asked that question because we have a bill up tomorrow that would change some of this, hopefully. But currently, right now, under statute, any healthcare professional must turn in a woman who is pregnant if she tests positive for any substance other than alcohol or cannabis. So right now what is happening, obviously, with the opioid epidemic is, especially at Hennepin County Medical Center right now, we have between 6 and 12 babies born because the women are terrified of coming in. So I just wanted to clarify that question that, yes, right now, currently, they are supposed to be reported to social services.
All right. Thank you very much. All right.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Lane, I think we're going to move on,
right,
if that's okay. This kind of is a bit of a side issue to the bill. I'm just going to give our authors a chance to say a final word. Representative Tice, do you want to make a closing statement, and then Representative Mann, and then we'll lay the bill over?
I just want to thank everyone for hearing this. I think the reason, so many of them, folks haven't heard about doulas, speaks to the fact that we need to raise this a little bit more and hopefully get more doulas available. You can also see a woman who's pregnant, who's maybe her husband is deployed and isn't living at home and doesn't have somebody to help her. A doula in that instance would be so welcome as well, just to have that friend, that person that you know and trust with you during the process. So thank you for hearing this bill.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Okay, Representative Mann's going to pass on it. So thank you very much, testifiers and everyone, and thank you to the folks that stepped up. We did get your materials. We will look at them. We appreciate that. And the bill is laid over for possible inclusion. The bill as amended, let's see, I should probably say the number of the bill as well. It is House File 259 as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance bill. Thank you very much. All right, we will move to House File 1664, Representative Gomez. And the chair will move that House File 1664 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Should I go ahead and
yes, please go ahead and present your bill.
All right. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. House File 1644 would fund an appropriation to an organization in North Minneapolis providing low-income families of color with culturally appropriate birth and postpartum doula support and education. to expand their services, the services provided by this organization, with the goal of reducing disparities in maternal and infant health in communities of color. So this is really, you know, I guess I think of it as kind of a companion to the bills that we were just talking about. I'm not sure how much you guys have talked about the, you know, the issue of racial disparities in maternal and infant outcomes in this committee, but the U.S. has the worst maternal and infant outcomes in the industrialized world. This fact is driven by the deep racial disparities in these outcomes. So, like, overall, Minnesota, when you just look at our birth outcomes, we rate pretty good. But if you disaggregate the data, we also have one of the most stark disparities in outcomes between women of color, particularly African American women and American Indian women, and white women. So, in Minnesota, in 2015. Babies born to black mothers and American Indian mothers were twice as likely to die while they were infants as compared to women born to non-Hispanic white mothers. By every measure, black and American Indian babies are more likely to experience bad birth outcomes. Black moms are twice as likely to suffer from postpartum depression. And this can just have really far-reaching consequences for mothers and babies. The Wilder Foundation did a study just last year that said that, you know, postpartum depression costs the public $23,000 a year. These disparities along racial lines persist even when you control for socioeconomic status, education, location, all of those things. They're truly not about anything other than race. Luckily, there's something that we know that works, and that's culturally competent doula care, which is what we were just talking about. Representative Mann went into the impact that it has on cesarean rates, but doula-assisted moms are also four times less likely to have a low birth weight baby, which is a predictor of kind of later issues, two times less likely to experience a birth complication involving themselves or their baby, and significantly more likely to initiate breastfeeding. You know, more than half of women of color who give birth in Minnesota are on Medicaid, and so those low reimbursement rates that we were just talking about really, a couple folks talked about, Representatives Hamilton and Olson both asked about kind of doulas that are in the pipeline, and the data shows us that when the background of the doula matches the mother, that the outcomes are better, and so the combination of the low reimbursement rate and the high rate of women of color giving birth on MA has kind of like meant that we don't have the doulas of color that we need to assist moms in Minnesota. And so this bill is designed to address that issue.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Gomez. Do you have a testifier here?
I do. Claire Sharp is the executive director of AHAVA BirthWorks, and she's going to come up and offer some testimony.
Welcome to the committee. If you would just give us your name and state who you're with, and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Claire Sharp. I'm the director of AHAVA BirthWorks, which is a culturally congruent doula organization. So the doulas that work with AHAVA are African American, and we serve African immigrants and also African American families. Because doula services are very, like, people know about doula services. They're highly recommended, and so we narrowed the folks who we could support. So right now we're working really with high-risk families, and those are women who are HIV positive, women who have mental health disorders, and homeless moms and mothers who've had open child protective service cases and are dealing with that system. So those are the families that we're working with, and yeah. So, I don't know if there's...
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions from members? Okay, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And so for Ms. Sharp, Representative Gomez, thank you for bringing this bill forward. We know the statistics around low birth rates and death among African-American babies and Native American babies. And, you know, we're here because, you know, it's no predictor of income. It's just the traumatic stress, the trauma that we as individuals have to deal with in everyday situations that impacts our health and well-being. And so when we look at doulas and the work that you do, what is the difference between you doing it as an African-American woman and having more African-American individuals working with those populations?
Okay. Awesome question.
Ms. Sharp, please. We have this weird thing we have to do, so sorry. Go ahead. Sorry, Madam Chair.
Yes. So what makes a difference is why the culturally congruent care matters so much is that people want to see people that look like them. I often say that as Black people in America, we're bilingual. You know, we speak English, but we also have a different unspoken language within our own communities. So that's really important. We're able to be comfortable and really talk about real issues that impact our pregnancies. We can talk about, like, I had this experience. This is why I had the experience. This is why I feel the way I feel. And it's coming from a person who can understand it. So that really does matter. And I can say, since we've been doing the work for 5 years in the community, we have seen no infant deaths, and we have seen zero small babies. Our babies are at term, and they're born at the way they're supposed to be born. So there's something to really say about that in itself, and why it's so important for people to see folks that represent who they are in the community, and it makes a difference. So that's what makes a difference. And also, when you're going to home visits, typically, it's awkward to have someone come into your home who doesn't reflect the same culture as you. I think this has been a thing that's been talked about in Minnesota Home Visiting Nurses Association, and just period. That cultural piece does matter, I think, no matter what culture you are. But in particular, with African American folks and Indigenous women as well, to be able to have your culture represented in such a very personal way.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran. You know, sometimes we in this body say, well, we don't have enough doulas. Well, where are they? They're not out there. Are there Indigenous and Black doulas?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, we train doulas. Oh, my gosh, the politics of this thing.
You're doing great.
I'm trying to get it. Okay.
Oh, this isn't even the politics.
Okay, hold on. Right?
Please go ahead.
Yeah, so we also have father doulas now who work with men who are going to be new fathers. I think that's an important aspect to the work that we're doing as well. But, yes, there are definitely doulas, and we need to train more. There's not enough. So that's why this bill is so important, so that we can get funding to train more folks to do the work.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Ms. Sharp. Okay, I have a couple. I have more members on the list. They have Schumacher, Olson, and Halverson. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the bill author, I think with this one, just looking at how the bill is constructed, the description of who the grants would be eligible for, is there one center that does this, or are there multiple centers that this would be more of a competitive grant?
Representative Gomez.
Chair Liebling and Representative Schumacher, thank you for the question. Well, luckily, there actually are at least three agencies who would qualify to apply for this that provide these services in the geography that's identified. I would ask Ms. Sharp if there are others.
Ms. Sharp.
There are at least three.
There's at least three, but the way this grant was written, or this bill was written, is that it would incite other people to start doing the work that we're doing, because three organizations can't possibly fulfill the need. So it really pushes other folks to go out there and encourage them to do the work as well.
Great to hear. Thank you, Madam
Chair. All right. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just super excited that we're doing these bills today around doulas, because I think it's a really good point just to recognize, too, that when good outcomes match lowered costs, I think we've hit a sweet spot. Mm-hmm. And I think when we talk about culturally specific doulas and we talk about, we also heard, I remember White Earth, when they were in testifying about some of the really interesting work they were doing when they were able to do culturally specific work with pregnant women, the better outcomes for their kiddos too. So I think it's a nice place to be when we're sitting on a finance committee and we're talking about great outcomes and lowered costs when people don't have to have complicated births and follow-ups with hospitalizations and whatnot, and just sets kids up for and families up for success. So I really appreciate this bill as well.
All right. Thank you. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just needed to kind of lift up what Representative Gomez said. She asked us a question. I don't know how much you've talked about disparities in maternal and child health outcomes, and I said to my, you heard it, not enough.
Yeah.
Not enough. There's a lot we don't understand about why this bill is so necessary, and I think we're starting to understand it more, but I think this is the place that we really need to talk about it, and we need to talk about the historical trauma, I think, that exists in the communities regarding healthcare, because it, you know, brown and black bodies have been used for horrible medical experiments historically. In the distant past, during slavery, and in the recent past, when you look at the Tuskegee syphilis study, where people were infected and never told and studied. And so it makes a ton of sense that we need these cultural competencies, because there is a lot of trauma that people need to heal from historically, and there's no better kind of goal in terms of healthy moms and healthy babies. I think that, you know, this is the foundation of our communities, making sure that we have healthy moms and healthy babies, and that people can prosper. And the other thing I think that's so significant and really is telling about this schism in our healthcare system is that your economics aren't a factor. It is simply the color of your skin. That is stunning to me. And it kind of, it came into the news, into the popular culture news, when Serena Williams suffered a near-fatal postpartum incident. And so this is a big deal with deep roots, and so I hope that we can continue to have more of these kinds of conversations about where we need to mend a lot of community trauma with regard to health care, and that's all I wanted to say. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Gomez.
All right. Thank you, Representative Halverson. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That question for the bill's author in reading the bill, and thank you for bringing this forward, Representative Gomez. This is a really interesting topic, but the way that the bill's written, it says that the grant funds must be used to support and expand the culturally appropriate services provided by this organization. So on line 1.3 of the bill, and it just seems that the language is written a little vague. Was the purpose of this bill to be used directly for paying for services of these individuals, or could it be used for capital investments, building or buying vehicles or something for this? And then also, it says it's a one-time appropriation, but it's available until expended. Is your expectation that it would be used within 2 years typically, or is this a small amount that would be available for over many years?
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Munson. So when it says culturally appropriate services provided by, I think that's that this is directly to support the organizations and the services that they provide to mothers, babies, and families that they serve. This is not intended to be used for capital investment or for other purchases besides that sort of, you know, direct services that are provided to the families. And to your other point, you know, this is a relative to the need in our state, this is, and frankly in North Minneapolis, this is a small amount of money, and so I expect that it will be used up in 2 years. I'm not positive, though. I mean, I could be wrong.
All right. Yep. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you again, Representative Gomez.
All right, thank you. And I do have a question as well, and that is, you know, first of all, some members made some great comments. I'm also really excited to be hearing these bills, and thank you for bringing this, Representative Gomez. I wish we had you on our committee maybe next term.
Hopefully.
But my question is really about whether there are interactions with this and other work that we're doing with home visiting you know, we're actually, there are a lot of proposals moving through this year about how can we do better for families? How can we do better to have more healthy pregnancies, more, you know, support our youngest kids? Because we know that a lot of the gaps begin even before birth, and that what we do in the very earliest, through the pregnancy and in the earliest days of a child's life and weeks and months is really, really important. So we are, I think, looking at home visiting, actually Representative Pinto's subdivision of our division is looking at that specifically. But is there any interaction here? Is there crossover with some of services that would be provided that way? Ms. Sharp.
Representative Chair. Yes, Madam Chair, sorry. Yes, there is a lot of, so we do work with Minnesota Visiting Home Nurses, and we will be at home visits with them. So, yes, so there's that, there's a lot of overlap in terms of home visiting, yes. And actually having that cultural piece at home visits where the clients that we work with, they're more comfortable to have someone, they feel safer.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Representative Gomez?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Liebling. And I just also want to, you know, Ms. Sharp kind of covered this, but Representative Halverson talked about that, that sort of some of that mistrust that exists in communities of color when interacting with the medical system. And so, you know, the visiting nurses program is so valuable, and, you know, it's borne out in the evidence, as is this these investments in doula care. But, you know, I just really think Ms. Sharp makes a really important point about having a person who has established a long-term trusting relationship with the entire family, being able to kind of be that interface with the medical system. That's a lot of what doulas do, is that like, I mean, every woman in the room who's given birth knows that, like, when you're having a baby, it's like you're in an altered state of mind, and it's really difficult sometimes to advocate for yourself in these systems. And so when I think about the interaction between a doula program and a Minnesota visiting or the visiting nurses, it's kind of similar. You're hopefully not in that altered state of mind anymore. It's like a different thing, but you know, but yeah, having that kind of enduring relationship with the family to interface with that medical system, I think, is really important.
Yeah, thank you. And last question, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And so, as I am so supportive of this bill and know the needs of it, I just came back. And so, a friendly amendment is that, you know, my district, which is the Rondo community, which is high populations of African Americans. We have a Native American Center that's been built right now in my district. I know the African American Baby Coalition is doing great work, whether it's in Minneapolis or St. Paul, along with the Wilder Foundation that's leading in these conversations. So my hope is that we can expand this, not to just North Minneapolis, you know, but also look at St. Paul. You know, if you can go statewide, that's just more money, that we need to look at the need of this to really making sure that, you know, the birth of babies are so critically important, but so much of this work that happens so much before birth, right? And so creating outcomes and making sure babies are coming into this world fully developed with, you know, not at low birth rates or at birth rates, but just great outcomes happen so early in this process during the pregnancy, and the need is so great. And just to state that Ramsey County does have some of the worst disparities, and so we got better. We definitely have work that we need to do, I know, in my county, which is Ramsey County.
All right. Thank you, Representative Moran. Thank you very much to Representative Gomez and Ms. Sharp. Thank you for being here. And so House File 1664 is laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you. Oh, we have the going from the very interesting to less interesting. Is there a motion to approve the minutes of March 13th? Representative Hamilton moves approval of the minutes of March 13th. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Thank you. The minutes are approved. Okay, we will move now to House File 1011, Representative Mann. And Representative Mann will move that House File 1011 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. And Representative Mann, do you want to present your bill? Or
yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Please. So House File 1011 is a grant program bill to increase funding for the Family Planning Special Projects Grants. This grant program has been around since 1978, and currently there are 24 grantees of this program located throughout the state. The grant can be given to cities, counties, nonprofit organizations for the purpose of pre-pregnancy family planning. And the purpose of the program is really to provide this care throughout the state to people who have barriers to care, so low income, people who don't have insurance. Because this kind of care, so pre-pregnancy care, has been shown to decrease unwanted pregnancies, allow women to space out their pregnancies, which is causes significant good health outcomes for moms and babies. And it has an economic impact by decreasing health care costs and increasing economic security for families. The state has not been able to keep up with the demand for these services, and hence the reason for this bill. And luckily, the governor has included some money in his budget for this. With that, I'd like to introduce my testifier.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Alyssa Light, and I have the great privilege and honor of being the board president of the Reproductive Health Alliance, as well as executive director of Family Tree Clinic. The Reproductive Health Alliance is the statewide coalition representing the Reproductive Health Safety Net. Our 16 organizational members have clinics in 67 locations and reach hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans in every corner of the state. And therefore, we know firsthand the power of preventive reproductive health care and what it means in the lives of Minnesotans. Reproductive health care is, in fact, basic primary care. It's a fundamental component of the primary care safety net in our state. Reproductive health care includes preventing unintended pregnancy through access to contraception and education, preventing cervical and breast cancer through routine screening and treatment, and serving as an entry point, which is really important for so many people who experience health disparities and socioeconomic barriers in health care. Reproductive health care in Minnesota is a critical, high-impact investment in our communities, our futures, and our public health. To highlight the breadth and impact of RHA member clinics, I wanted to share a couple stories that they've shared with me. One of our organizational members located in West Central Minnesota wanted to share the following. This is Mojave Otwa Community Action. They provide comprehensive family planning services to low-income people in rural communities of West Central Minnesota, ranging from homeless teens to college students, families working their way out of poverty. In parts of the state like theirs, where many people already have trouble accessing the health care they need, it can be difficult, especially for low-income rural Minnesotans, to get basic reproductive health care at critical junctures in their lives. They wanted to make sure that the committee knew that increasing Family Planning Special Projects funding will help them protect rural access to care and help their clinic on a whole reach more underserved people in their communities, and the need is profound. Another RHA member, face-to-face health and counseling on the west side of St. Paul, primarily serves teens and young adults experiencing homelessness. They shared this story from January 30th, 2019, which we may remember was a polar vortex day. It was negative 30 degrees that day. Schools and local government were closed. Face-to-face was open. And they wrote this story at the clinic this afternoon. A young person walked in needing medical care without warm clothing, shelter, or food. This young person was not wearing a coat. Not only did they have their medical care needs, face-to-face staff helped them find a coat, clothing, socks, gloves, a hat, warm soup to send with her. They sent her to a shelter and paid for the cab to get there. And one of their longtime staff remarked, "What's happening right now in room one is why we're open, even if it sucked for me to get here this morning." Not only was face-to-face open that day, they also extended their hours. They added another meal at their drop-in shelter, which is in downtown St. Paul, and ended up serving an additional 100 youth that day, is my understanding. This would not be possible without the Family Planning Special Projects Grant, and that's not because the Family Planning Special Projects Grant funds those kinds of direct services, but it's a critical part of what keeps the doors open for these critical access family planning health centers. At Family Tree, where I serve as executive director, the FPSB funding allows us to go into juvenile detention centers to provide critical outreach throughout Ramsey County that would otherwise not be offered. It allows us to be in shelters and transitional housing, and it funds the only deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing health education program in the entire state. Reproductive Health Alliance members on a whole offer many social services in addition to the Family Planning Service direct medical care, and we feel that's important for the committee to know. And that does include homeless drop-in shelters, youth development services, health education, transportation assistance. Ultimately, the Family Planning Safety Net in Minnesota is reaching our most vulnerable communities, and we're doing so with on-the-ground solutions that benefit our state on a whole. All of this highlights how robust and powerful the Reproductive Health Safety Net is, and how incredibly robust and important and far-reaching the Family Planning Special Projects Grant Program is. And now we all have a powerful opportunity to do so much more, and that is because the infrastructure is already well established, and we know the need to be profound. So on behalf of the hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans we serve, whose stories we're honored to receive and whose care we are honored to be in service to, we request that you continue to say all Minnesotans' health and well-being is important and that no one should be left behind. And we believe that House File 1011 is an opportunity to do just that. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Light. And I can't help but think about that young person that you described walking in and thinking, that could be one of our daughters, right? I assume that was a female person,
she
as
was.
You described. And, you know, that could be that. That young woman is somebody's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right. We have some questions from members. Maybe before we ask those questions, I should just see if, well, let's go to the questions, and then we'll see if there's anyone else in the room that wants to testify. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To this one, to the testifier, Ms. Clarkquist, despite our best efforts in Minnesota to date, could you tell us roughly a percentage of women in Minnesota that don't have access to this sort of primary care?
Ms. Light?
I believe, according to Guttmacher, that about 40% of women in Minnesota are lacking access to basic family planning care.
And, Madam Chair, one more question,
Madam
please.
Chair, excuse me.
Ms. Light?
Okay.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One more follow-up. Just wondering about the percentage of unplanned pregnancies in Minnesota. Do we have any data on that?
Ms. Light.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Bierman. I do have some statistics. Let me pull them up. Forty percent of all pregnancies in Minnesota are unintended.
Thank you very much.
That, again, is according to the Guttmacher Institute.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Cantrell, sorry I skipped you before.
No problem, Madam Chair. Thank you so much. And to Representative Mann and to Ms. Light, I just want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. And, Ms. Light, I wanted to thank you for everything you do in the pursuit of greater access to quality health care for folks who need it the most. I have a lot of folks in my family who at various times throughout their lives haven't had the resources to otherwise seek good quality health care. And so they've relied on these services quite a bit. It breaks my heart that folks, especially young folks, don't have homes and don't have warm food to eat. And the fact that this money can go towards providing a little bit of light in their life, I think, makes a tremendous amount of difference. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on House File 1011? All right. Seeing none and seeing no other questions from members, thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Thank you, Representative Mann. So House File 1011 is laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right, House File 963, Representative Halverson. So Representative Halverson moves that House File 963 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm happy to be bringing this bill before you today. It's a bill designed to protect and expand access to contraception in Minnesota. Birth control is essential to health and economic well-being of women. And nearly 9 in 10 women of reproductive age will use birth control at some point in their lives, many of them for reasons beyond preventing pregnancy, including medical reasons like treating endometriosis or fibroids or controlling migraines. However, I firmly believe that it's not the business of the legislature why women are choosing to seek contraception coverage and contraception health care. That's the business of a woman and her doctor. It is our business, however, to make sure that women in Minnesota have access to all possible health care for their needs. Contraception allows women to plan and space their pregnancies and their births, leading to healthier outcomes for the moms and the babies. For instance, research shows that women who use birth control plan their pregnancies are more likely to get prenatal care, less likely to give birth prematurely, and less likely to smoke during their pregnancy. Contraception also protects women with pre-existing health problems from serious medical complications that could result from an unplanned pregnancy. It's the collective benefit, the direct health benefit, the maternal health benefit, and the accompanying economic and educational benefits that women get from being able to control their own reproductive lives that prompted the Federal Centers for Disease and Centers for Disease Control to name birth control as one of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century. To ensure that women in Minnesota can continue to plan their families and their futures by accessing birth control, regardless of cost and free of unnecessary barriers, House File 963 does two things. It puts the ACA requirement that insurance plans cover FDA-approved categories of contraception at no out-of-pocket cost into our state law. And it allows Minnesotans to receive up to a 12-month supply of birth control at a time covered by insurance. At least 11 states have already codified the ACA birth control rules into their state laws, and 19 have enacted laws that allow patients to receive an extended supply of birth control at once. Recognizing that sincerely held religious objections of certain employers, House 963 does not require houses of worship to cover contraception if there are religious objections to doing so. Nor does it force religious nonprofits or specific for-profits to pay for contraception coverage. Instead, 963 mirrors a current federal process by having the insurer directly cover the cost of contraception, thereby ensuring access to no-cost birth control for all employees. How insurance covers contraception is key to whether and how women use birth control. Thanks to the ACA birth control rule, more than 62 million women, including a million Minnesotan women, have had access to birth control without co-payments or additional costs. But the cost barriers removed, women have been turning to more effective, longer-term methods of contraception, and unplanned pregnancies are declining. Putting the ACA birth control rules into state law will ensure that Minnesotans can and will continue to access the birth control method that is right for them, freeing them from concerns about cost. In addition, allowing healthcare providers to prescribe an extended supply of birth control at 12 months at a time will help eliminate gaps in coverage that is associated with relieving those gaps in coverage is associated with decreases in unplanned pregnancy. Birth control is basic health care. I urge you to join me in supporting this common sense bill that will help it protect and expand contraception access in Minnesota. And Madam Chair, there are two testifiers on this bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Halverson. Who wants to go first? All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much.
Give us your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dr. Kristen Lyerly. I am an obstetrician gynecologist from Plymouth, and I am a member of the Minnesota American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. I also have a master's degree in public health, so this is especially important to me. I am here today representing Minnesota ACOG to voice my strong support for HF 963. Minnesota ACOG represents over 1,000 physicians and partners who care for women across Minnesota, and we support this state-based affirmation of the rights of women to freely access the full range of FDA-approved contraceptive methods without cost-sharing or other barriers. Access to contraception supports healthy women, healthy babies, healthy families, and healthy communities. Now, this might surprise you because pregnancy is so common, but pregnancy can be risky, and it often is. Diabetes, blood pressure problems, blood clots, many other complications can arise, even in women who were previously healthy. These conditions can last throughout a woman's lifetime and sometimes result in pregnancy-related death or severe morbidity. And in fact, the U.S., embarrassingly, has easily the highest maternal mortality rate in the developed world, as we heard earlier, ranking 46th in the developed world. And unlike our peer countries, our maternal mortality is actually increasing. Simply put, when a woman gets pregnant, she is accepting a risk to her own health and to her baby's health. I would like to share a few numbers for you to consider. Nationwide, 50%, approximately 50% of all pregnancies are unplanned. 18%, that's the decrease in unplanned pregnancies after the ACA went into effect. And in Minnesota right now, our numbers are actually better than the 40% that were quoted earlier. They're 36%. The ACA is working for us. During the same time and for the same reasons, the abortion rate nationwide decreased by 10%. And one more number, 99%. 99% of sexually active women have used some form of contraception at some point in their lives. 99. This is relevant. For many women, contraception is much more than just birth control. Women often rely on contraceptive options to control pain and bleeding. And did you know? Contraception can prevent cancer, ovarian cancer, and uterine cancer. It's true. And what about the babies? When I told my 10-year-old son this morning that I was coming to talk to you all, and I told him what I was talking to you about, he said, well, of course, babies are expensive. And he was right. And he wasn't even taking into consideration the additional costs that are more commonly associated with the offspring of unplanned pregnancies, preterm birth, low birth weight, NICU stays, and poor physical and mental functioning in early childhood. Perhaps most importantly for your purposes is the financial aspect of ensuring that the women of Minnesota have unfettered access to effective evidence-based contraception. Every $1 spent on publicly funded family planning services saves Medicaid over $7. Spend $1 on prevention, save $7. Not even taking into consideration the intangible costs of unplanned pregnancies to women, families, and communities. Looking at it from a different perspective, in 2010, unplanned pregnancies cost federal and state governments $21 billion. We spent $21 billion in 2010 because of unplanned pregnancies. And importantly, we know that properly spaced pregnancies promote not only better health for moms, but also increased workforce engagement and economic self-sufficiency, so everybody wins. Contraception prevents unplanned pregnancies. Birth control is preventive care. When women are able to control their own reproductive lives, outcomes are better for moms, babies, families, and communities. As the federal protection of contraceptive coverage is increasingly weakened, let's work to ensure Minnesotans have consistent, no-cost access to the full range of contraceptive options. Every woman, regardless of her insurer, her employer, or income, should have easy, affordable access to the right form of contraception for her, free from political interference. So please join us, the physicians who take care, we specialize in taking care of women and supporting HF 963. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Laura Hermes. And I just want to let everyone know we only have 10 minutes left in this hearing, so we do want to make sure that we have time for members to ask questions and for perhaps others to testify. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I'm Laura Hermer. I'm a professor of law at Mitchell-Hamlin School of Law. I teach health law and health policy and specializing in health coverage, and also teach a seminar on reproductive rights. House File 963 builds off the foundation of the Affordable Care Act, as we heard earlier. And if enacted, it would be a real win-win for everyone. Women and men would win, families would win, employers would win, insurers would win, and the state wins. Before the ACA's preventive health provisions went into effect, birth control was a necessary but expensive burden for individuals. The burden fell almost entirely on women's economic shoulders. Whether they were insured and had to pay deductibles, co-payments, and co-insurance with respect to the costs, or were uninsured and had to pay the entire bill. Studies have shown that the use of contraceptives among reproductive age women inversely correlates with expense. As costs for users declines, the use increases. On the other hand, if contraceptive use declines, the rate of unintended pregnancy increases. The National Business Group on Health reports that unintended pregnancies are more likely to produce children with poor health and who are more likely to suffer from abuse or neglect. Employers pay not only in increased insurance costs, but also in lost productivity and time away from work. But the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation found in its 2011 review of the cost of covering contraceptives through health insurance, along with the Affordable Care Act, found that evidence from well-documented prior expansions of contraceptive coverage indicates that the cost to insurers of including coverage of all FDA-approved contraceptive methods and insurance offered to an employed population is zero, and that was a quote. When considered alone, contraceptives added about 0.5% to the per-person cost of health insurance, but when one takes into account the savings from reduced prenatal and maternity costs, the ASPE determined that the net cost of providing first-dollar contraceptive coverage is close to zero. According to one PricewaterhouseCoopers estimate, maternity costs alone constitute nearly 4% of employer health plan costs. Now, Minnesota already requires health insurers in the individual and group markets to cover prenatal and maternity care. And fully insured plans must also cover prescription drugs under state law, which under federal law, further federal law, include prescription contraceptives. But this alone does not include all efficacious methods of contraceptives, nor does it include out-of-pocket costs, which, as mentioned earlier, affect the utilization or lack thereof, and hence also unplanned pregnancies. Now, unplanned pregnancies are more likely than planned ones to be covered by public funds. For example, a report from the Guttmacher Institute found that in 2010, public programs funded nearly 67% of unintended births in Minnesota, as compared to only 26% of intended ones.
Ms. Hermer, I'm sorry, but I have to ask you to wrap it up.
Oh, thank you. Okay. All I'd like to say is, as a result of the regulations under the Trump administration, which are currently stayed, but they may not be, and so we need this law to help protect individuals who are covered by fully funded plans in Minnesota and cover their contraceptive costs. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take questions.
All right. Thank you. Well, we have one. Representative Haley.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Halverson, for the bill. I just want to kind of understand the scope. Are there currently health plans that provide this coverage in the manner that you prescribe in the bill?
Representative Halverson. Madam Chair and Representative Haley, they all should be currently under federal law. The concern is that federal rules are being changed or being debated about being changed, and that could change the way Minnesotans receive their insurance benefits.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And does federal law require a 12-month supply of prescription to be given regardless of where the individual is in a plan coverage year? So it's November, it's the end of the year, the plan doesn't know, you know, we switched our health plan at the state level, and then you're going to switch to a different provider, but you would still be required to give somebody a full 12-month prescription? Is that federal law, or is that new in your bill? This is subsection 3.
Representative Halverson.
Representative, Madam Chair and Representative Haley, that is not covered under federal law. That is a new allowance in state law. So that because having this onerous, you have to go in every 30 days, every 3 months. The doctor might be able to speak better to that than I can.
No, that's fine. Can I ask one follow-up?
Please.
I know we have a time
Haley. Thank you. Permit.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. That was new. I thought that shouted out to me as being new. To your knowledge, are there other drugs that are considered similar to, again, to your proposal, birth control as being so necessary that we provide a 12-month prescription without any copay?
Representative Halverson.
I think I'm just being asked to speculate on if there are other classes of drugs that are really important to people, and I think that I just would stick with this bill. I think, you know, there's a lot of ways that we can talk about making sure that Minnesotans have access to the care they need. This is really vital, basic health care that is at risk. So
I'm just kind of concerned about precedent.
Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Halverson. I'm just concerned about precedent here of maybe we're wading into other waters that we're not sure of unintended consequences. Thank you for addressing my questions. Thanks for bringing the bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Haley. Representative Munson. Oh, I'm sorry, Matt. Couldn't read the
sure.
Right.
Sorry.
I'm so used to having it be Munson.
I'm not. I'm just responding to Representative Haley. I'm not quite sure I fully understand the question, but if I did, we have a lot of medications now that we do prescribe for a year. So like your blood pressure medication or your cholesterol medication, we can give a one-year prescription of those. So this is not a new concept by any means.
All right. Thank you, Representative Mann. Okay. Okay. Representative Halverson, we've got like 2 minutes, 3 minutes. Do you want to wrap up, or maybe one of your testifiers has something, final statement?
But I just think that this is a really excellent and important bill, and appreciate members' support in making sure that Minnesotans have access to basic health care.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Halverson. Thank you very much to the testifiers. House File 963 is laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance bill. Thank you very much. And with no further business before the committee today, we stand adjourned.